Okay, so we've got that recording started, and then I need this document. Okay, so here's my first message coming through. I'd like to welcome everybody. We've got our whole team here today to the first or the second conference call for RM102 Document to Manage Risk. And I'd like to acknowledge I'm hosting this call from the traditional territory of the Kwanlin Dun First Nation and Tonkwashen Council. Last week, we discussed documentation that related to participating in programs and also for people using your facilities. So this week, as you have already found out, we're looking at documentation that's related to operations. And that might include things like facilities, checklists, user agreements. David, I think you posted some contracts in there, so those are definitely operational documents. So I saw your post this morning. I haven't read it yet, though. Thanks. So since documentation can prove that you're doing what you say you're doing, documentation, as we mentioned, for operations could include the contracts that David posted. It might include policies and procedures that you have, either for your programs or for your staff. And also, a more recent addition to operational documentation has been guidelines around the pandemic. So that was a lot of documentation. With public health restrictions. We don't always need to have tons of documentation, like documentation takes time, but you want to make sure that you avoid any issues. So, you know, a user agreement for your facility, if you have groups that continually leave your facility dirty and don't clean it the way they're supposed to, a user agreement or a policy and procedures around that is really important to have, because that written piece helps you follow through when things aren't working the way you think they should work, but the written piece also makes sure that things technically should work the way that you would like them to. So before we get into the types of documentation that contribute to safe operations, let's do a quick introduction, and I'll tell you how I see you on my screen, and we'll go around in a circle. So across to my right, I see David, and below David, I see Peter, and then I see Anne, and then I see Spider. So we'll go David, Peter, Anne, Spider. And if that order jumps around on my screen, we'll change the order. So the question that I have for you is really short, just to start off the introduction. Just a really quick introduction. I think we can all see who you are. We all know each other. So you can even just say hello, good morning. But what I'd like to know is I'd like to know how much documentation you use on a scale of 10, where 10 is way too much, to 1, where 1 is almost none. So I'm just curious to get a sense from you how you feel the volume of your documentation is. So over to you, David, for a quick intro on a scale of 1 to 10, from almost none to way too much.
Hi, everybody. I think I've met everybody. Hi, David, Elder Aptus. How much is too much? Too much. I think we use too much. I'm on a scale of 10. I think 5 would be a good measure, and I'm saying this from the participants' point of view as well as the leaders' point of view. It takes a lot of time to input that data, scan, digitally input it. So I think a happy balance would be 5.
Yeah, that's probably well spoken from Elder Active, as Elder Active Recreation Association has, what, over 600 members?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot. So thanks, David.
That's a lot.
Over to you, Peter. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much documentation do you feel you use?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. Well, I haven't really gotten into too much documentation at RPA yet. I would say maybe about like a 4 out of 10 or 5. Maybe Anne can correct me. At the CDC, I want to say we don't really use that very much documentation when people are using our facility, like hardly any at all. the one I showed you, like you said, there's like waiver, anonymity, informed consent. It was all just like smushed into one document. That was like barely a page long. It didn't really tell you anything. And that's what they use for all the youth, for example. But at 3 adults, they don't even need to sign anything.
Thanks, Peter. I noticed my videos disappeared from the screen. That's got to be my intranet, probably. So I am still listening, though. My apologies. I can't make it pop up back up again. Not giving me that choice. So, yeah, thanks, Peter. I guess a little bit more documentation in your new role at RPE than what you were doing at the Game Center. And over to you. You'll just need to unmute yourself and maybe share with us on a scale of 1 to 10 how much documentation you use.
Oh, there we go. Sorry, it wouldn't unmute for me. I don't think we probably don't use enough, but I feel like it's overwhelming to make sure you've got it all done and you haven't missed something. Because there's a lot to it, right? And I'm just thinking about things like our back steps at the office, where we shovel them and sort of haphazardly write it down from time to time. And it's like, well, there's another form we need to write down when we shovel so that it's documented, right? But I know, I guess it's just all part of managing risk, but... it just sometimes feels a bit overwhelming.
Thanks, Anne. Yeah, it definitely can be for sure, especially when it seems endless. So thank you. Over to you, Spider. How about yourself on a scale of 1 to 10? How do you feel about the volume of documentation you use?
If I talk about risk thing, I might say 1. I have 1 document. It's the assumption of risk, waiver of claims, and release of liability agreement. It was drafted by a lawyer at the Sport Law Group. We paid our $350 for it. If I look on the Sport North side, especially around games time, there's a number of forms that they need to submit when they do their territorial trials or registration for the games themselves. Things like a photo release, I think there's a liability release. I don't play a big role in that, but merely if I'm tasked upon having people make sure they complete it, then I do that. So for wrestling, it's very little. I suspect it's too little. And for athletics, we should at least work on the assumption of risk, waiver claims, and release of liability agreement. But we don't formally run any events. We did, we were going to run our trials last year, but the flood in Hay River nixed that, so we just went with a paper review of people's times from accredited meets to get on the Canada Summer Games team. So I did mention last time, I think that if an agency got on board with a company, say like an Interpodia, where so I understand it, you could get sort of a one-stop registration. You get that registration number for life. Maybe when you go to register for your next thing, it'll bring it up and you just quickly say, this is current, or make those changes. And then it's straightforward, I think, then to get people in, and they're not waiting around or having to keep entering or re-entering. I think there's enough technology out there now that people could do that.
Thanks. So that's a good introduction to what we're going to talk about today. I just posted in the chat again. My apologies. I don't know what's going on. I can't get my video to restart. So got to be the internet out here. but I can definitely, it's great to see you guys. And you got a little funny picture of me on the screen. So my apologies. Let's move on. What I'd like to do today is I'm going to do something that I call like a hot potato type circle. So I've got a whole bunch of questions. But in order to fit them in, we have to go around our circle quite quickly. So we'll take the same order each time. And, nice background, David. That makes me want to go somewhere where it's not snowing. There's something in the ice in the background.
That was a selection. Mount Kilimanjaro just has a point of interest. They announced on the news today there's a big fire on Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Okay, so what we're going to do right now, and Peter's got a snowy background too, so there you go. it's fun playing around with that, isn't it? Okay, so we're going to take a bit of time to review the content from slides 20 to 29. So let me test this out and see if I can actually share. If it doesn't, it might not let me share it because I might have a window. Let's see.
We can see you, though. We see your... We don't...
Can you see,
see
me or just... Okay, can you see my
see
screen
live.
Now?
You're
you can see me
live.
Live? I just...
No, not now. We see
okay.
You.
Yeah.
Can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Okay, it must be my feedback. It's just not showing me what I'm seeing, what you guys are seeing. So, okay, so let's take a look at documentation for operations starting on this slide. And so this time, as I mentioned, our circle is going to be like a hot potato circle. So I'm going to ask a question. I'll also pop it in the chat. So if the answer comes to you really quickly, you can answer in the chat, or we'll just go around our circle. So it'll be like a two-minute go-round. So just like really short answers so we can get all the questions and all the content in. So starting with slide 20, you can see that many types of documentation can be used for operations. This is different, as I mentioned, than the type of documentation for participation. So documents for operations are usually prepared or filled out by your organization or another group or agency. On slide 21, which is that one, whoops, right there, if you can see that, if it's loading properly, let me know if things aren't loading and I'll stop the screen share. It lists some, we just went through some of the documents that are used for employees and volunteers. So you might use position descriptions, contracts, volunteer agreements. So my first question for you is, what other documents do you use for employees and or volunteers? So we're going to ask David first, one document that you might use for an employee or for volunteers that's not on this list.
I'm going to say travel documents.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Peter, one document that you might use for or have used or have experienced that's for employees or volunteers that's not on this list?
Vulnerable sector check.
Okay. Thank you. And Anne, any other employee or volunteer document that you might use? And I think Anne might be muted. So we'll come back to Anne. Spider, how about yourself? Any other documents that you use for employees or volunteers?
On the volunteer side, I think I'd work to incorporate templates like an EGM agenda template or a standard meeting template.
Great. And that just means that people can run their meetings, for example, or they use a template and there's consistency, right? So people know what to expect.
Or they add new topics, maybe the agenda's got a reminder that an opportunity to declare any conflicts of interest, especially with our communities where we've got a lot of people wearing different hats. And yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, so slide 22 introduces what Peter just introduced, which is great, which is criminal record checks and also vulnerable sector checks. So you can see here that, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the fact that a vulnerable sector check is a little bit more in-depth than what a criminal record check is. It looks for a little bit more things. And ideally, your organization should have some policies around what you do with those. So my question to you, Dan, is which one do you use? And do you have sort of a process around what you do with it, like how long is it good for or where do you store it? So I'll just go in the same order so that everybody knows when it's your turn. So David, over to you. Do you use one of these checks? Which one?
Yes, vulnerable sector. Yes, we use the vulnerable sector check. Once I've received it back, it goes into the volunteer or contractor's personal record. Nobody sees it other than myself. and or the executive director. And I keep it in the envelope. Once it's been approved, it's dated, and the envelope is resealed.
That's great. Thanks. That's a really good. And do you have those processes written down somewhere so that if somebody else took over from you, they would know sort of how you're doing that?
No.
Ah, okay. So that might be something to add, just a, you know, a note or something like that.
I think that would be a good one.
Yeah, because if something happened and you know, were off for a month or 2 months and somebody else was looking after it, you wouldn't want to come back and find that it was handled very differently, right, in a way that doesn't respect privacy and things like that. So.
Exactly.
Awesome. Thanks, David. Peter, over to you. And you can either comment on with ARPE or also maybe at the Game Center, but probably if you're familiar with what ARPE does, it'd be great to share that.
Unfortunately, I haven't collected any vulnerable sticker checks. I have had to give them before, and usually it's if I'm working with youth or a vulnerable population. I know that when I worked at Gazooza Residence, we had to like physically bring in a copy. Like you couldn't just scan a copy. It had to be like the actual signed document because there's like some formal process that the document goes through. I don't really know, but I thought that was interesting at least.
Yeah,
and
that is.
Obviously you want to maintain confidentiality. I think I only submitted it to the HR representatives.
Great. So you are responsible for the Real Leader program at ARPE, and that's a requirement. So you could maybe get into how you guys handle that at ARPE. Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks. And you're still muted. I can see if you unmute, and then I'll include you in the question as well. But let's go to Spider. Spider, which one do you use, the criminal or vulnerable sector check, or neither? I suspect you use one of those.
For the coaches, we want to use the vulnerable sector one. If it's just athletes, so for example, Sport North has its Arcadia Games coming up. It requires of team personnel and coaches and volunteers and chaperones the vulnerable sector one. But if an athlete is over 19, then they just need to, because they just need to get the criminal record check. As an aside, the RCMP has updated what the content required of the letter from a sponsoring agency requiring the criminal record check. There's certain components now that are required in the letter asking for a criminal record check. And I'm looking for the one that I have. This isn't it, but it's similar on similar letterhead. That they you get that from then, and now they're very particular, certainly here in Yellowknife, that all those components need to be met in the letter. They do give you a sample of what the an acceptable letter is like. So that's new here in Yellowknife anyway.
Okay, if you could share that would be great. I know I've added some of the links there to where you can find those things on the RCMP page, but that would be great. Before we go to Anne, David, I see your hands up. Did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, what I was going to ask is, which do you prefer? They can mail the record check directly to the volunteer or personnel person, or the person can pick it up and then bring it in personally, and or... You know, the delivery method to the organization, is there a preferred method?
That's a good question. Spider, do you know what they do with Arctic Winter Games? It's probably going directly right to the organization and bypassing the person, because then it's one more set of hands to go through.
Yeah, I think we just need to get the record. Some agencies will have signed up with Sterling Backcheck, so it's quicker and somewhat easier for the individual. And then I think when you're going through that online process, you can say and send a copy of the record to wherever. Altruistically, I think it's better for it to go to the individual in case something's arise, and we don't want to further. We don't want them to be further, you know, blemish themselves, let them get it sorted out and provide us with the document. If they don't choose to provide us the document, then they, or for whatever reason, they can step back and say, I changed my name, mind, I'm not going to do this. And only then when, they've seen their own record, they're comfortable with its contents, and then they send it to us. If it's not a proverbial clean record, then hopefully we have a process on how that's handled. Certain things to do with assault and abuse. That's no brainer. They don't get any further. But if it's a speeding ticket for whatever shows up on a criminal record from many, many years ago, and they've turned that corner and
I think, well, Anne, you were going to add to that. Oh, sorry. I'm just going to let Anne have a quick thing, and then we're going to go on to the next one, because I think there's, you know, the answer probably there is it depends on, you know, the size of what it is that you're doing, Arctic Winter Games versus a couple of volunteers. So, Anne, do you want to weigh in on if you use the criminal or vulnerable sector check and how you handle those? I think we're, are you there, Anne? I know you're unmuted, but I can't hear you.
We look at those depending on the program, and through the WAFO really. Are you still not hearing? Oh my goodness.
It's just cutting. Actually. Yeah, I can hear you. It's just cutting in and out a little bit for me, but that's probably because I'm sharing my screen. So I'm just going to stop sharing my screen because it's probably at my end. Okay, go ahead, Anne. Okay, so let's go on then from criminal record checks. Oh, go ahead. I can hear you now, yeah.
Oh, there's like a huge delay.
Okay, go ahead.
And we collect them in a common file folder, which we keep in a specific file drawer, and then when we need to renew them, we'll add to that content. But really what we should be doing, I think, is having them in a locked file drawer, because we control access to the office where the files are located, but we don't lock the drawer. So, that's what we do.
Yeah, so definitely keeping in mind, you know, sort of how you secure some of these documents is really important. So if we go on to slide 23 then, slide 23 introduces policies and procedures. Now, I try to keep this simple because policies and procedures could be, of course, all on its own. So basically then, a policy is something that...
Real quick, and then we'll get back here.
Oh, I'll just mute you there, David. There we go. A policy outlines an organization's guiding principles or rules, while the procedure describes how it should be carried out. So policies and procedures that are written provide clarity and guidance. So I'd like to ask you if we can do this as a hot potato round again. What is a basic or simple example of a policy and procedure that you use? So we'll go David and then Spider, or David, Peter, no, yeah, sorry, he has changed on my screen. So David, Spider, Peter, Anne. So David, do you have an example of a policy or procedure that you use that's written?
I didn't go through all of our documentation. I know there's a procedure we use for taking payment and registering new members to the organization, but I don't think I've ever seen it as a written procedure. So the procedure, you know, is it's multiple steps. I'd say there's about 11 steps in it, but I haven't seen it actually written down A to B to C to D.
Okay, so then that would be the procedure, like what actually happens. The policy would be something like, People can't participate in our programs until they've actually filled out the membership form and paid. That might be your policy.
Right.
And then the procedure might be how that's carried out and what happens if it's not followed. So if somebody hasn't paid, sorry, we're not going to let you participate until you're completely a member and it's for liability reasons or whatever. Thanks, David. Spider, do you have an example of a policy and a procedure that goes along with it? It doesn't have to be complicated, just a brief example.
We have the Sport North leave and overtime authorization form. We're just told to make sure that's completed. So the finance person says, I don't have the form, so I have to get the form completed, signed by the executive director, then the finance person will put it into play. On the policy side, I guess it's part of the employee handbook that talks about overtime and leave and the obligation of employees to complete the form.
Great, thanks. So policy handbook has certain policies in it for staff, and then there's procedures about how you need to carry those out. Thanks, Spider. Good example. Peter, how about yourself? Do you have an example of a policy and a procedure?
Maybe for like the Real Leader program, it'd be like a policy would be like a Real Leader has to run a program that includes physical activity. Is that work? Is that answer?
Yeah. So
I can't see your reaction already. Procedure would be like there's like we have an application process on our website and they have to go through this step-by-step sort of questionnaire before we can apply.
I think that's a good example of a program policy. So the program policy is that the program, if you receive funding, has to include physical activity. And then the procedure could be how that's carried out. So people apply. They must provide a description of their program. They must let you know what type of physical activity. And then in their report, maybe they have to report on how many minutes of physical activity per hour or something like that. So there's another example. And I know you're having some delay, and I'll watch your phone. It shows that you're muted right now. If you wanted to unmute and weigh in, or if you just want to listen, if it's too frustrating, that's fine. But do you have an example of a policy and a procedure?
Yeah. One of the ones that I think we've got really well written is our travel policy. So it outlines sort of all the requirements for if we're going to cover the cost of travel for people. And then the procedures part are things like, if you're going to rent a truck, we'll only pay for gas. If you're going to use your own vehicle, we'll pay this much per kilometer. If you're going to book an airline ticket, you have to use the lowest fare available, book it 2 weeks prior in advance. Like, there's a whole list of policies or procedures that go with that policy, but I would say that's one that I think we've done a good job on.
That's great, and we'll come up to some of those ones too, so that's a really great example. And I'm just going to pop the example that I came up with in the chat because it goes back to our conversation from last week when Spider was talking about safety glasses. So you guys can read that one while we move on to the next slide then. So slide 24 touches on policies that might be related to training and certification. So for example, you might have training that's required for employment, on-the-job training. You might specify who needs what type of training, when and how it takes place, or the certification that's required for the certain type of job. So I'm just curious, this is a really quick answer, and I'm sure you guys all know the answer to this one. What do you see as the difference between training and certification? And it looks like David's busy right now, so I'm going to start with Spider. Quick difference between training and certification.
It's my understanding certification is based on a test. If it's like the National Coaching Certification Program, for example, Make Up for the Citizens, you can go to the 4-hour workshop in person online home study, but you're not certified until you've gone online and taken the test.
Great, that's a good example. Peter, anything to add to that, to what Spider just explained?
Yeah, similarly, like a certification usually comes from like a governing body that is like sort of nationally or internationally recognized. Whereas training can just be like kind of anything, seemingly.
There's not really any regulation in that. I don't actually know, though. But
yeah, that's it. And do you want to weigh in on that, too? You know, add to what Spider just explained and what Peter sort of enhanced. And from your experience, would you agree with what they sort of shared about the difference between training and certification?
Yeah, I totally agree. Because sometimes we've got leaders that don't have a certification per se because maybe sometimes there isn't one that even exists for a particular activity. So there isn't sort of like a, I'm going to run an after-school program. There isn't a, well, maybe there is through High Five, I guess. But some programs, there is no certification program to have. So then you've got to kind of look at, well, what's the training that maybe this person has had or needs that might not be a actual certification.
Thanks, Anne. And David, I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to ask you a different question. So why is training and certification important to risk management?
It validates. Yeah, that's okay, but it's quite all right. It validates integrity.
Yeah, and it also is a good risk management tool because what you're proving is that you have people that have the right experience and things to be doing the programming that you're doing. Peter, did you want to add to that? I see you unmuted.
Yeah, I had a really good example of that, like, because I have a degree in kinesiology, but because kinesiology is like a sort of new, relatively new degree, when I started my job at the CDC as a fitness specialist, they demanded that I get a personal training certificate, which I could do in like a weekend, which is like a way more reduced version of the stuff I learned in school, but they had to have it as sort of like a policy for like applying to the job. And they actually put me in an underfilled capacity. I was making 10% less until I had completed those certificates, which was infuriating, but I understand, I guess. For kin in the north, at least. There is in D.C. and there is in Ontario, but not up here.
Yeah, and so that's that. The organization's way of making sure that they're covered is for their staff to have that certification and making sure it's current. David, did you have something to add? Is your hands up?
Yes. What I was thinking is, let's say you're a doctor, for example. You've got the certificates, the PhD, whatever. As a professional, you have to update and show consistent recertification or consistent updating of your degree. Now, I have a degree in conservation biology, but there's not a requirement for me to update it specifically. Now, in terms of recreation, like this certificate program that we're doing here, this training program that we're doing here, is there, you know, must maintain every 2 years, like a first aid certificate must maintain every 3 years for, you know, as I said, proof of integrity. You know what you're talking about. You know you're going to be safe, whatever, when other people's lives are involved.
Yeah, so recreation's a little broader as far as there's specific certifications, like Anne mentioned, High Five. We often require people to have, you know, as Peter pointed out, a fitness trainer certification. There's loads of certifications in aquatics. Recreation North is not the same type of certification as a training program. What the Canadian Parks and Recreation Association has done and is in the midst of revamping is a professional development certification. And that would require those ongoing credits and refreshers, as you mentioned. I'll let you know where we get to with that. I'm sitting on a committee that is looking at renewing or revamping that program. And we actually, Recreation North training program has permission for us to ladder people who've completed the certificate you're working on into their professional development certification. So once we get that sorted out, I will give you updates on how that works, but that would be, I think that's a really broad answer too. That's a big question. We could talk about it for the whole, probably the whole hour, so thanks. So if you go on to the next slide has alcohol and cannabis, or, you know, maybe even more broadly substances. The reason I picked alcohol and cannabis is because these are ones that in our society are legal. I did not include illegal substances because they're simply illegal, and, you know, the policies and things around that are a little more straightforward. So you do need, I believe, that anybody, especially if you're running recreation events or operating recreation facilities, needs to have something around, some policies around alcohol and cannabis use and procedures around how to administer those policies. So I have a really quick question for you. I don't want to dwell on it too long because, again, this is could be an entire hour conversation. But what might be one consideration that you have to include in a policy that's related to alcohol or cannabis? And I'm going to put Peter on the spot this time and start with Peter, then go to Ann, then David, then Spider. So thanks for letting me put you on the spot, Peter. What might be just one thing to consider in that type of policy or procedure?
Like, instructor and participants are not allowed to be under the influence of cannabis or alcohol, especially if it's a high-risk activity. If it's something like Nordic walking, I mean, it's good to just cover all your bases, so definitely don't do it, but definitely lower risk if it's Nordic walking, but it's something just probably for the best, I might as well.
So would you say that that's a zero tolerance for alcohol and cannabis in recreation programs, or it would depend on the program?
I guess it would depend on, like, our level of liability, but I would say probably zero tolerance is, like, the safest bet. But, again, if you're just doing, like, walking in the woods, obviously that's not going to – like, but the thing is, what if someone's very, very intoxicated and you're in the winter? So, like, I would just probably just say zero tolerance, but – I know people still do it, so it's kind of like, this is a good thing I'm learning this, because now I don't really know the answer.
I don't know if there's a straight answer either, so that's why we're talking about it. Thanks, Peter. Anne, over to you. What is one thing that you think should be included in a policy or procedure around alcohol and cannabis? So Peter said acceptable use. That would be one thing, acceptable use. What is something else that you would include?
We have a cannabis policy that we developed, for RKM, and it's a no tolerance, like it's a thou shalt not use cannabis when you're representing RKM at work, or, I don't remember that it asked the participants though. It talks about staff and contractors and leaders. And it's based on the recommendations from the Workers' Compensation Health and Safety Board, because obviously there's a risk of having workers high at work. So I forgot what your question was, but.
Well, I think that you just built on what Peter said. So the question is, what might be part of a policy related to alcohol or cannabis use? So you and Peter have both touched on when it might be permissible or not, or like the zero low tolerance sort of thing for both staff, contractors, leaders, but also participants. So there's a lot of other elements that you might need to include. So David, do you have an example of something else that might be included in such a policy?
Let me unmute myself. Oh, I am unmuted. Okay. First of all, I think the number one policy around alcohol should be, if you have it, share it. No.
Okay.
I knew Peter would laugh at that one. Okay. Obviously, I agree with others in terms of a zero tolerance, but having worked with the Yukon government and other organizations, generally what you'll find in a policy is the first time offense is a letter of reprimand. Second time offense is could be a suspension, probationary period, whatever. Third offense, bye-bye. You know, because with government and organizations, the way they're coming together now, is you have a duty to accommodate. So if it's alcohol, is it an alcohol issue, one-up, or does this person have alcoholism? Is it a sickness? In which case, duty to accommodate would suggest on the second offense, or even on the first offense, you may say, well, we have an alcohol recovery program, or we may want to assign you to a 28-day program. We're here to help you through the illness that you're suffering from, as opposed to a simply one-off, sorry, bye-bye. Now, during a probationary period, I could see the one-up bye-bye. So that's...
Okay. I'm just going to jump in there because we're trying to do the hot potato thing, and your potato's really hot in your hands there, just so that I can get through all the questions. About what you said is that you can have a policy, like Anne and Peter said, but you need to have procedures about how you address that policy. So thank you for that. Spider, is there something else other than that you might have to include in a policy related to alcohol or cannabis that you see as important to include?
Yeah, I think vaping needs to be added.
Okay.
We look at the Sport North 2023 Arctic Winter Games, and then in the event discipline procedures, further down talks about alcohol, tobacco, cannabis. Athletes should not consume alcohol, use any tobacco or tobacco-like products, including snuff, electronic cigarettes, you know, water pipe, whatever. So what I did was, my wife actually worked for the Canadian Cancer Society, had the smoking reduction portfolio. So I had her put together the description of how, that encompasses the, you know, the types of, you know, cannabis or whatever. And so that was used. I think we could update this to talk about alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, and vaping. And then in turn, what we did is we, at the games, we created these, welcome to our smoke-free environment, outdoor environment. And now this now, though, needs to be added with a an image of no vaping, with the no vaping symbol. So
that's great.
The policy, okay.
Thanks for sharing that, Spider. I think that's great to see that you take the documentation and put it into something that's visual that you can use. I think the other thing I wanted you guys to think about is it's not just about who's using it, but it's also about where it's allowed. So my understanding of the rules is that the use of cannabis is different in NWT to the Yukon. So there's the different jurisdictions have different places or locations that are allowed. You might also, if you're responsible for a facility, need to address the process about where alcohol might be permissible in a facility, especially if it's a user group, what type of serving is needed or training is needed for servers, things like that. So those would be some of the other things. It's a pretty big area, so all of these are big areas. We could have many conversations about these. I'm just going to flip through a couple more here. So as on slide 26, we've already mentioned travel and talked about travel. So you know that travel is a high risk for us in the north, particularly in winter. Policies about participant travel and staff travel should be different. So you should have your policies for staff, contractors, coaches about transporting participants, and then you should have different ones if staff and volunteers are traveling. Again, a travel policy outlines what, and the procedures outline how. That is also related to the next slide, which is cold weather, and I won't get into too much detail because we all know about cold weather, but where it gets complicated is that temperatures vary by the time of day and also the location. So if you are saying our cutoff temperature, David, you might be doing this for Nordic Walking, our cutoff temperature is minus 20, make sure you tell them at what time and by which account. Like, does that include wind chill or not? Is it on, like, Environment Canada website or another website. At what time will you consider that temperature? So try and make sure that you're really clear so people aren't looking at different sites at different times and trying to come to a conclusion about what that actually means. I'm going to go on to the next one without asking a question here. So checklists. If you're in the chat, pop an example or more of a checklist that you actually use for whether it's for an activity, event, or a trip. So checklists are really great sort of documentation things that you can use to manage risk. It can make sure that you're doing what you say you're doing. It can make sure you don't miss issues in your facilities. It can give you an inspection schedule. So if you have a checklist that you use to help you reduce risk, maybe you can just pop your answer for that into the chat. So Peter has a safety checklist. You might want to expand on that. A safety checklist for whom or for what is what I would ask for that one, Peter. So maybe you can clarify that a bit further. Hopefully you guys can still hear me on my phone. My screen is completely frozen, and I think it's probably happening to Anne too. So my apologies. That's great. Thanks, David. Equipment and safety checklist. Awesome. And an orientation to the gym. Those are really important, Peter, in rural communities as well, for weight rooms and things like that, because often you won't have somebody monitoring that weight room in a rural community. So that orientation is really important as well. So I've got one last big question. Sorry, I missed the slide. User agreements is another huge area. User agreements describe expectations and conditions for the groups who might be using your facilities. And you need to make sure if you're using user agreements that you indicate whether or not a group is required to have their own liability insurance. When we get into the next RM103 learning event, Understand Legal Risk, we'll talk more about things like occupier's liability, which comes into this joint use agreement and rental agreements or contracts. And I'll give you an example there when we get to that one. So I have one last question that I'd like to do around, and I see that Spider's the one who's not muted. So Spider, we're going to start with you, but I will pop it in the chat so you can see the question. Then we'll go to Peter, and then Anne, and then David. So here's my question. What changes in documentation for managing risk in general have you noticed in the past few years? So Spider, I suspect you've been involved in documentation for managing risk for a while. What changes have you noticed over the past few years?
Certainly in the insurance industry now, if I want to get insurance for any of the sports that I represent, they want to see the safety, the safe sports policies that you have in play. And then if I want to buy extra coverage for abuse, then I have to buy that separately, and it's going to be a high expense. But I can't buy insurance now unless I provide them with board member approved safe sport policies that relate to abuse and harm and neglect and so forth.
Okay, so they have a standard sort of slew of documentation that you're required to provide, which maybe 10 years ago it wasn't the same extent.
3 years ago it wasn't the same.
3 years ago, it wasn't the same. Okay, so big changes in the insurance world and the impact of that on documentation for you to manage risk using insurance. Thanks, Spider. Peter, help me yourself. Have you noticed any changes over the past few years in documentation to manage risk?
Well, I mean, I don't really know, but an easy one is like COVID. Like, definitely completely changed how people manage risk and document risk.
What did you notice more through COVID that changed?
Well, the risk was associated with other human contacts, so it was like basically every single space had to be revamped and like rearranged to allow for people to be following public health guidelines, or else
Yeah, and probably a lot more documentation. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, like science documentation, yeah. Like you said.
Yeah, sorry, there's a big delay in how I'm hearing you and seeing, so my apologies. But yeah, so not only how you manage your spaces, but also how you document that, which we didn't have to do before. So thanks for that, Peter. And how about yourself? What changes have you noticed in documentation for managing risk over the past few years?
I think awareness has really shifted. I think there's way more awareness around risk and documentation. And it reminds me of the horrible incident that happened with the ice plant. I want to say Fernie, BC, but that might be wrong, but there was a horrific plant with the Arctic ice plant, and people died because of it, and I think really raised awareness of the industry around facility use and maintenance and documentation.
Thanks, Anne. And David, how about yourself? What changes in documentation for managing risk have you noticed over the past few years?
First of all, let me apologize for my going in and out. I'm the only one in the office right now. Secondly, as I have only been here 6 months, I've noticed no changes. Yeah. You know,
okay.
I used what has been handed me and said, here. I'm going, okay, but if I just briefly, because I know this is hot potato, if I briefly repeat what I heard is Alex has brought the documentation to a higher level and introduced a number of new procedures on handling it over the last couple of years.
That's great, and we just identified one for you today too to work on, which is to put how you handle criminal or vulnerable sector checks, to put that on paper in case somebody else ever has comes in and looks after it. So I guess the changes are ongoing then, and I would say that, yes, Alex has probably done a lot over the past few years, but you might identify some things yourself moving forward. That's great. Well, thank you so much, everybody. This wraps up my apologies for my internet. They are running fiber optics cables out this way. I'm not sure how long it'll be till we actually get it, but hopefully sometime in the next year. So this wraps up our last conference call for RM102. Please make sure that you do the activities like Spider was asking about, activity number 4, and check out the Explore More section before you do your last required learning activity. And you guys also have the opportunity, I guess mostly it applies to Anne and Peter, but you guys can work on your RLAs or required learning activity together too if you want to, and submit one for both of you. You know, David and Peter, you guys could get together if there was something that touched on both of what you're doing, or, you know, I don't mind people working on things together if two of you have sort of the same interest in something. So we can think about that moving forward as well. Please make sure that you do your feedback form in activity number 7. Those are really helpful for me. And you've got a week off. There is no conference call next week. It'll be your catch-up week. And then we move into RM103, which is Understand Legal Risk. And just so you're aware, that's a 4-week-long learning event. It used to be 2 weeks, but it was way too much to put into 2 weeks, because even like Peter's question that you asked, Peter, about your release of liability, we spend almost an entire week on waivers and those sorts of things in RM103. So that's why it's a 4-week-long one, and then it'll be Christmas. Oh, my gosh. So thanks so much. Let's just do a quick round. You can say goodbye. Happy Halloween. Happy winter. David, you're unmuted, so let's start with you if you want to say bye to everybody.
Bye, everybody. And anybody? No. I don't like using the word everybody.